Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. You don't look Jewish. People said that to Dani Shapiro all the time when she was little. Dani grew up in the Jersey suburbs of New York. Her parents were Orthodox Jews. She's blonde with blue eyes.
I did look so different. I always felt there was a secret, but I didn't know the secret was me.
Dani kept thinking a lot about family and upbringing as she got older. She wrote several memoirs, one about trying to reconnect to her family's Jewish faith. She had portraits of her ancestors hanging on her walls. Then, a couple of years ago, Dani's husband got interested in genealogy, you know, ancestry.com. And he said, hey, why don't you try this? So Dani spit into the vial, more as a joke, and she got her results back. She looked them over and she was startled.
Okay, wait a minute. This is showing that I'm 52% Eastern European Ashkenazi and the rest is this smattering of Western European countries.
She thought she would be 100% Ashkenazi. Then she got a notice from Ancestry.com. You have a first cousin who's also on this site. Here are their initials.
I knew all my first cousins, and here was this first cousin who had unfamiliar initials. It was a complete stranger to me.
Dani was getting suspicious. Something wasn't right. So she reached out to her half-sister from her father's previous marriage. That half-sister had also done a DNA test a couple of years earlier.
She sent her results. We compared the two kits, and we were not sisters.
Dani was not who she thought she was. Her whole life, she had felt really connected to her ancestors.
And suddenly, I wasn't.
Her sense of identity had been shattered. Who was she now?
So that was this kind of profound loss. It was like losing an entire half of me in some way. It was a rootlessness.
Our identities have lots of components, from DNA to looks, our communities, ethnic backgrounds, our professional affiliations, to our religious beliefs. It's a big part of our personal narrative. On this episode, we explore how our sense of identity defines who we are and what happens when that identity is challenged. So, Dani Shapiro has just found out she is not who she thought she was. Her parents are both dead. Nobody else in her family seems to know anything. She racks her memory for any clues, and she remembers a conversation she had with her mother in the 1980s. Dani was 25 then, and she had taken her mom to an event at her graduate school near New York City. She introduced her mom to one of her friends.
My mother said, oh, Rachel, very nice to meet you. Where are you from? And Rachel said, Philadelphia. And my mother responded by saying, oh, my daughter was conceived in Philadelphia.
Dani said, what are you talking about, Mom? I never heard that. And her mom said,
oh, you don't want to know. It's not a pretty story.
Later that night, when Dani was driving her mother home, she kept asking her. Her mother said only a few things.
She told me that there was a world-famous institute in Philadelphia, and that there was a doctor who ran that institute who was famous for having pioneered a method by which a woman could pinpoint precisely when she was ovulating. And that she and my father had had trouble conceiving me, and they had gone to this institute, that my father had slow sperm, that was the phrase she used, and that it was there that they did, as she referred to it, the procedure.
The procedure was artificial insemination, still a somewhat new frontier in the 1960s when Dani was born.
She said, I would call your father in New York City, where he worked, and he would come racing to Philadelphia in order to do the procedure.
Now Dani is thinking about this long-ago conversation, trying to digest the new genetic information she has just gotten. She's trying to figure it all out. Philadelphia, the institute, the procedure. She hops online.
Well, it was just a couple of Google strokes, really. It took very, very little time.
Up comes the Ferris Institute for Parenthood, which was run by Edmund Ferris, a scientist who did a lot of work on ovulation and who specialized in male infertility. Scientists and doctors started experimenting with artificial insemination in the 19th century. But male infertility was very much a taboo topic, since masculinity, virility, and fertility were thought to go hand in hand.
The idea is that if you were capable of having sex, if you were a man, you were fertile.
Margaret Marsh is a historian, and she co-authored three books about the history of fertility medicine with her sister, Wanda Rahner, who is an OBGYN.
So it was very controversial. They had the technology to do it. Microscopes look at the sperm. But even up until the 1930s, there were some infertility specialists who said, oh no, men are rarely the cause of infertility.
Physicians who were doing artificial inseminations at the time tried to concentrate a man's sperm. If that didn't work, if they needed donor sperm, it was usually kept quiet.
There were some doctors who advised women not to even tell their husbands.
Really? Why?
Yes, because the fear was that the husband would reject the baby.
Margaret says that was more the exception. Most doctors did tell both parents and made it clear that donor sperm would be used. But they did try to create ambiguity. They mixed sperm from the husband and a donor to introduce uncertainty. And they used donors who resembled the husbands.
But there never were any questions raised about, well, is this child going to be caring who his or her genetic father was.
Many of the donors were med students or grad students working in a lab.
A lot of times the doctors didn't even keep records, later records, of who the donors were.
Dani Shapiro is learning all of this as she researches her mother's fertility procedure. She sees the euphemistic language that doctors are using, talking about treatment, boosting chances of having a child. If the procedure was successful, the advice to women or couples was,
pretty much forget that it had ever happened.
And the donors?
No big deal.
You're helping a family have a child. You're making a couple of bucks.
There was guaranteed anonymity. The thought that there might be a future in which, you know, people could spit into plastic vials and send them off through the mail and get their DNA mapped and be identifiable to each other and with, you know, this thing called the internet. I mean, all of this would have been pure science fiction.
Then he realizes that the donor who is responsible for half of her DNA probably was a med student.
It only took me 36 hours. To zero in on my biological father, just with a few clues.
The most important clue is the first cousin that popped up on her ancestry page. Dani finds him on Facebook. That leads her to his mother's obituary, which mentions two surviving brothers. One of them is a physician who went to med school in Philadelphia. She watches a video of him on YouTube. Her husband recognizes gestures and facial expressions. It's all completely overwhelming. Dani starts typing out an email to this stranger.
I recently took a DNA test as nothing more than a lark. I have always believed my parents to be my biological parents. But now I have reason to believe that you may be my biological father. I'm going to send you a link to my...
She had emailed the right man. When he receives the email, he's in shock. He had donated sperm all those years ago as a very young man, and then he just never thought about it again. He hits delete. Dani reaches out again, and eventually he writes back. He tells Dani,
honestly, the thought that I had other biological children out there, meaning other than the children that he and his wife raised, honestly never occurred to me.
He says he doesn't want to meet, then reconsiders. Finally, they get together for lunch with both of their spouses present. Dani and this man look at each other. There's some recognition.
When I met him, the feeling that I had about him was that he was very familiar to me, that that expression cut from the same cloth, I felt that.
They talk for hours and decide to stay in touch. And the man she called father her entire life?
I believe that my dad knew.
In her research, she found that both parents signed papers at the Ferris Institute that were clear about using donor sperm.
And that I was born and looked nothing like my dad or his family.
Dani says discovering her history, that biological part of herself, answered lots of questions about her identity and that nagging feeling of being different. But it doesn't change how she feels about her father.
My dad loved me and I loved him, and I think that's why I'm sitting here.
After she pieced together this whole history, Dani goes to visit her father's sister. And she tells her aunt everything, all the clues, the pieces, and finally says, "Dad isn't my biological father." Her aunt grabs her hand and reassures her. She says, "You take something that isn't your own and breathe life into it. You create it, and it becomes your creation." Dani says her story is an example of how complicated identity really is. And that's an issue she says persists with reproductive medicine today.
It is the desire to simplify something that is actually really complex. It's a wonderful thing that there's, you know, all sorts of different ways that all different kinds of couples can make families. It's wonderful. It just also is complex.
Dani Shapiro wrote a book about her experience. It's called Inheritance, a memoir of genealogy, paternity, and love. Historian Margaret Marsh's latest book is The Pursuit of Parenthood. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott, and we're talking about identity, what happens when our sense of self is challenged. When you do a DNA test, you get a percentage breakdown of your ancestry. Sometimes they even include a map of where in the world you might have ancestors. It paints a more nuanced picture than the boxes we check on the census or for job applications: white, Hispanic, African American, Asian.
Just having the insight to our DNA, the recipe of what makes us human, gives us a whole different sense because it connects us in a way that we hadn't been connected before.
That's Anita Foeman. She is a professor at Westchester University in Pennsylvania, where she started an initiative called the DNA Discussion Project.
I mean, we all have DNA, and while we place ourselves in these discrete little boxes, our DNA is 99.9% the same, and so we start from the sense of a human identity.
Genetically, we are 99.9% the same, but yet we focus so much on what makes us different. Anita says ancestry is often a better way to speak about our differences than race or ethnicity.
I've done diversity training over the last 35 years, and I cannot tell you how many times you get called in because some awful thing has happened. Somebody called somebody a name, somebody did something insensitive, and you go into diversity training and everybody is coming in kicking and screaming. When we approach this with the ancestry DNA, we're coming in with an entirely different attitude. We're coming in talking about inclusiveness, and we're coming in with a level playing field. And so it's just such a much more exciting way to talk about our variety.
Give me an example of how a DNA test turns into a classroom discussion.
Okay, one of the things that we do is have everybody get tested at the beginning of the semester. We have lots of discussions about race and social construction and all of that. And then the results come back. I had a young man in my class who identified as white, and he said there'd been a story in his family that his great-great-grandmother was black and had given up her child so the child would have a better life. And he found 3% African ancestry. And so that story was really verified. I had another student in my class who said that her family said a lot of negative things about Asians. And then she turned up with like 13, a significant chunk of Asian in her background. And we think that maybe some of that prejudice was covering for the prejudices around them and trying to pass. And so there's lots of discussion among and between students about what it means. And it's just so exciting to then compare it to what's going on in society and conversations about race. So it just builds and builds.
Do you think our overall discussions have changed, though, given this knowledge that we really understand that the categories that I'm checking on the census, that all of us check, that are used in research, that we use every single day, those categories really don't make a lot of sense?
One of the first things that we found that we were exploring in it is that people do not change their identification because of DNA tests. You'll test somebody and they find something that is totally unexpected, and then they just double down on their identity. I had a young man who identifies as Irish, 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 and his background came up as British, and he said, yeah, that damn test, you know, let's get rid of that. And so we actually find that people do not. However, they do add this information to their narratives over time.
Anita is not saying that the identities or boxes we check are meaningless.
If you were talking about mass incarceration, if you were talking about income inequality, you need to talk about race in some particular ways that are socially constructed. If you were talking about medicine and how you target medicine, you need to talk about race in a different way. And so when we talk about social construction, we are saying, how useful is this definition? Does it help us? And when it helps us gain insight and understanding, we should use it. If it is not helping us, if it's limiting us, then we need to reconstruct it in different ways. The world just is. So we have to construct it through language or whatever, but we need to continually revisit how we construct it.
Anita says looking at DNA and ancestry, those percentages and where in the world your ancestors came from, it could give us more appreciation of our shared human history of suffering and migration.
I think we are joined as human beings in that human history is grisly. People don't leave a place because everything was great. There's a lot of famine and poverty and war. And I think having that conversation that connects us is important. And I think it helps us realize that we have to make choices about moving forward in positive ways.
Anita Foman leads the DNA Discussion Project at Westchester University in Pennsylvania. There's the aspect of how we think about our own identity and ancestry, and then how others view us. The Asian Arts Initiative in Philadelphia recently hosted a workshop titled Claiming Your Identity, where people could have an open and honest conversation about who they are.
You know, it's really, really tricky, and how do you put it in nutshells?
Michelle Fuji is the co-founder of Unit Zoju, a drum performance troupe from Portland, Oregon. She says it's tricky because identity has so many components.
You know, I could give adjectives of my own character. I could also talk about my horoscope, the fact I'm an only child. Family structures define who we are. Also geographic. You know, I'm a West Coast girl. For me, this idea of otherness has weighed heavily upon me. I'm a Japanese American, fourth generation.
Michelle's grandparents were interned during World War II, and she says that experience shaped her family for generations.
So I didn't grow up speaking Japanese, not from choice, but because they were too afraid. Going back to Japan, I, of course, was super clumsy with speaking. Japanese were just like, what's wrong with you? You look Japanese. And trying to explain like all that history, and you can't do that. There's a longer tale that can't be told in buying soap.
We're talking about identity, how our sense of self defines us. For many of us, what we do for a living is a big part of our identity. So what happens when an outside force threatens that?
Hello from the Bureau of Meteorology. We're here with an update on the ongoing heatwave and elevated fire conditions. Severe heatwave conditions are continuing today over a large part of New South Wales.
Australia is no stranger to drought, but the weather has been extreme in recent years, with record temperatures and prolonged dry periods. Scientists warn that severe heat waves could strike much more frequently by the end of this century. Climate change presents an economic threat to farmers in Australia, but it's also threatening their mental health and how the farmers view themselves. Ashley Ahern brings us this story from farm country in the state of Victoria. Victoria.
I visited Australia at the end of a long, hot summer. The landscape was brown, and farmers were anxiously waiting for rain.
When you're out and about, if you're talking to farmers, they're all talking about water. They're talking about, God, we need this autumn break this year or we're buggered. And a lot of people are hanging on for that last straw.
Nick James is one of those farmers. We're standing next to a dusty pasture on his sheep farm about 2 hours north of Melbourne. Nick's 32, with a beard, broad shoulders, and a warm, quick laugh. But he says these days he's had a hard time staying positive.
You see it every day, mentally, in people, and myself. Like, I've dealt with it before. When you're just that far in and you don't know what you got to do and you got to keep going, it's pretty draining sort of stuff.
A deep drought took hold in Australia in the late 90s. People refer to it as the Millennium Drought. And things haven't really gotten back to normal since then, at least not in the southeastern part of the country where I traveled. Over these past two decades, the region has seen significantly less rainfall than historic averages. 60% of the dairy farms here have gone out of business since the drought began, and water has become so expensive that some farmers have had to kill their animals because they can't afford to keep them alive. Nick had to cut back the size of his flock and change the way he manages his sheep. Back when water was affordable, he'd irrigate his fields and let his sheep out to graze freely. Now, he keeps them in a confined lot and feeds them hay, which also costs more than it used to. The drought and all the stress that has come with it has affected Nick's mental health. A few years ago, he was in a really dark place. He and his wife, Georgie, were pouring everything they had into raising their kids and running the farm. But Nick was feeling a lot of pressure as the water disappeared and the debt piled up.
But yeah, I just sort of become sort of not being so positive. I'm normally a pretty positive, upbeat fella. Always looking forward, and I'd just lost my sting, I think. Like, I'd had enough and I thought everyone was against me. But yeah, I think that's when I realised I'd hit rock bottom. I'd stopped being so positive, and yeah, I was definitely drinking a lot of alcohol and probably spending a bit of time in bed, I think. I was just down and out.
I talked to a lot of farmers when I was in Australia. They're a tough bunch who are used to figuring stuff out on their own. They don't like to ask for help. But the drought has made many of them feel helpless and out of control, and that's taking a toll on mental health. Anthony Hogan was part of a team that surveyed the social and economic impacts of the Millennium Drought on farmers across Australia. He's an honorary professor of sociology at the University of Sydney. Anthony says that to understand how climate change affects mental health in Australian farmers, you need a bit of historical context.
When Australia was founded as an English prison colony, and very early on they nearly starved because the ships from England took so long to come and go with stock and supplies, and they didn't know how to farm the country. And so farmers quickly became central to the nation. And in Australia we have a long culture about this stoic farmer who's inherited the family farm from generation to generation, who maintains the farm, feeds the country, and hands on a good asset to the next generation.
But farming today isn't the same as it used to be. Farming communities are shrinking as more people move to cities. The global market has made for steeper competition, and smaller farms are getting bought up by larger companies. Now, add climate change, in the form of more extreme weather events like long dry periods or floods.
And the accumulation of shocks, the breakdown in your sense of self, that you are supposed to be able to manage all this, you are supposed to hold this all together, you are supposed to be able to produce through tough times and hand on the legacy. Those pressures mount, and typically I think we have what I often call a convergence of factors, and somehow they intersect, and that's the window in which people, I think, just see suicide as an option, as a decision.
I've always thought of climate change as a threat to livelihood, and you're telling me it's a threat to identity.
Oh, absolutely. Identity is performative. I understand who I am by what I do and who I do it with, how I do it with, and importantly, that I'm good at it. Climate just destroys all that.
Research on Australian farmers found a 15% increase in suicide among men between the age of 30 to 49 years old during periods of drought. But Anthony says the numbers may be higher because suicide isn't always listed as the cause of death.
The leading cause of death in outback Australia is land transport accidents.
Which is code for?
Single vehicle accidents. Line yourself up with a tree with three or four large petrol cans in the back of the ute with the lid off, and as you're about to hit the tree, throw the cigarette in the back. They're the kind of scenarios we talk about. And the figures are there, and they're undeniable, and they're sustained.
If a farmer can make his suicide seem like an accident, his family can collect life insurance. It's a sort of final, fatal attempt to provide for his loved ones.
What I know from people I've worked with who've attempted suicide numerous times is that mentally they think there's no other option. Sometimes they'll be thinking, my family's better off without me. They're better off with the insurance payout, or I am such a failure. I am not worth living on this planet.
Jenny O'Connell is a clinical social worker and therapist in Shepparton, Victoria. It's a small urban hub amidst the farming country north of Melbourne. She's lived in the community for 50 years. Her husband sold real estate, and they raised their two daughters here. And that really matters. When it comes to therapy, Jenny says rural people can be skeptical about getting help from people who are not from their community.
They won't ask for help because they're very proud and independent. And, you know, quite often when there are some sort of catastrophic event, people come from outside. You know, there are lots of services that are thrown, money and services are thrown at the area short term, but they won't trust and they certainly won't buy in fully to the support that's available. And any work that's with farmers has to be somehow in their community and somehow born of them.
As the millennium drought wore on, Jenny knew she was in a position to help the farmers in her community. She and her husband, Patrick, started a program called Leading From Within that brought together small groups, just 4 to 6 people usually, to talk about trauma and suicide prevention. Jenny would hear about farmers who were struggling and invite them personally. Often, couples would attend together. They'd meet regularly, over a period of a year or more, and Jenny and Patrick would conduct the sessions together.
Patrick can always talk about things that, you know, he knows are common with men, and he will say things like, you know, we're pretty hopeless buggers, aren't we? You know, we always cover our feelings and we pretend we don't have them, we're strong and all that, but he said sometimes we don't feel like that, do we? You know, and the guys will find that much easier to relate to and often then start to share really deep stuff.
Jenny says farmers are often very connected. They share local news, information, contacts. But opening up and being vulnerable with one another is a bigger ask.
There are times when we've run sessions and we just come away absolutely humbled, absolutely in awe of the courage that people have shown to express this deepest stuff. You get to see the real humanity and then they can heal.
But taking that first step, working up the courage to get in your pickup and go sit down with a stranger and share things that aren't often talked about, can be the hardest part. It certainly was for Nick James, the sheep farmer we met earlier. He's one of Jenny's clients. When he was struggling, drinking a lot and staying in bed for days at a time, it was his wife, Georgie, who urged him to get help.
Georgie's pretty stubborn. She didn't really give me an option. She said, well, we're going to have to do something about this, you know. And
was it hard for you to decide to go see Jenny?
Yeah, bloody oath it was. I hated the first two trips. I didn't like it at all. I just didn't feel comfortable. It wasn't me. I think probably the worst thing is you think you're a bit of a failure. You're thinking, God, what am I doing here? You know, I'm bigger than this. I'm a grown man, you know. But yeah, I think when you get yourself in the zone and you listen to what the experts have got to say and you get yourself right, it's the best thing you can ever do for yourself.
There's still stigma attached to mental illness. No one in a small town wants people to see their pickup truck parked outside the therapist's office. When Nick first started driving into Shepparton to see Jenny, he didn't tell anyone about it.
Now I really don't give a shit, I suppose. To put it frank, like, I'd rather tell someone that I'm going to see a counsellor or a therapist and what the world of good it's done me and still is doing me. And hopefully that might change someone else's mind that's listening that's going through a hard time.
Nick's still worried about the drought, and he thinks about climate change often. What does it mean for his daughters if they want to be farmers when they grow up? Is this the new normal, he wonders? What if the rain patterns never return to what they once were? At least now, he feels more prepared mentally to face those challenges as they come. For The Pulse, I'm Ashley Ahern in Shepparton, Victoria.
That story was made possible thanks to a reporting grant from the Scattergood Foundation. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about identity and what happens when our sense of self is challenged. Ellen Sachs hid a major part of her identity for many years in many situations. She was a law student at Yale in the 1980s when she experienced a major psychotic break. She had to be hospitalized. It was a traumatic experience. She was forced to take medications. She was physically restrained, tied to her bed.
So my first 2 days, I was in restraints like 20 hours a day. Then for the next 3 weeks, 5 to 15 hours a day.
She was diagnosed with schizophrenia. Her doctors told her she would never be able to hold down a demanding job. They warned that law school would be way too stressful. Despite that, she went back. And then she decided to write for her law school journal about restraints.
And basically, actually went to see a professor of mine who was a psychiatrist as well as a law professor. And I said, you know, I'm writing my note about restraints. I said, they must be very degrading and painful. He said, oh, Ellen, you don't understand. These people are psychotic. They're not like you and me. They don't experience restraints as we would. I did not have the courage in that moment to say, no, we do experience them in that way. But it's by othering people that we allow things to be done to them that we wouldn't want done to ourselves or our families.
Ellen managed to stay out of hospitals, to control her symptoms, and to have a very successful law career through a lot of therapy, 5 times a week, and also medication, which for a long time she fought against.
Why did you want to get off the medication? What did the medication symbolize to you?
I mean, I think there are all sorts of reasons that I try and that other people try to get off medication. Side effects. But I think the big thing is what we call in the business the narcissistic injury of having a mental illness and needing care. So for me, I was like trying to prove that I wasn't really ill. If I could get off meds and do okay, that would mean that I didn't have this illness. And it's a shame that it drives people to get off care because basically for someone who needs medicine, being on the medicine is what helps you go forward in your life. Put the illness to the side instead of having it be front and center all the time, fighting against it, fighting with the meds.
How does your illness manifest now?
You know, I have a friend who's a bipolar lawyer and writer, she doesn't practice anymore, and writer, and we talk about, quote, passing as normal, which I think I do. So I think I can be quite ill and people cannot know about it. I do confide in my closest friends and my husband. And, you know, the way it shows itself, I guess, when I am open with other people is I'm having crazy and scary ideas. So that's how it manifests itself. But for the most part, I'm able to hide it, which is actually an asset because it means you can sort of navigate in the world without getting in too much trouble. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, I always know enough to know that even if I think my thoughts are true, people will think they're crazy. And I don't want to appear crazy, so I just don't say them out loud. Or if I feel like I can't not say them out loud, I'll go home, you know, and not be around people.
In 2007, Ellen Sachs published a memoir, The Center Cannot Hold. It became a bestseller.
What was your motivation for writing the book and to sort of go public in a huge way?
Well, I didn't know how huge it was going to be, of course. I wanted to give hope to those who suffer with schizophrenia and understanding to those who don't.
Ellen says what helps her stay well, in addition to therapy and medications, is simple.
Connect with people and work hard. That's what does it for me.
Ellen Sachs is a professor of law at the University of Southern California. We're talking about identity, how we see ourselves, how others see us, and what happens when our sense of identity is challenged. Dating can be nerve-wracking. You're trying to have a nice time, to have a good conversation, but do you feel comfortable with this person? How much do you really want to share about yourself? It can get complicated. Jad Slaman has more.
Music, good-looking 20-somethings, red solo cups, it's a house party. Past the bathroom and a string of Christmas lights is Isaac, tall, dark, and handsome. He's chatting up Sophia, smoky eyes with a red halter top and hoop earrings. And it's obvious, they're feeling each other. The party is running out of booze. They're deciding what to do next, and Isaac has an idea.
I got some tequila at my place. Why don't we head over there? It's a little crowded here.
Let me think about it.
Sophia heads to the bathroom. With her reflection in the mirror, the debate begins.
Just tell him. Get it over with. You are smart and funny and beautiful. Who knows? Maybe he actually likes you. Just be yourself.
These are the opening scenes to Nava Mao's short film, Waking Hour. She's a trans woman, and she plays Sophia, who is also trans.
I think we all kind of understand that sometimes people meet at parties and they go home together and they have sex.
Nava spoke to me from Houston.
And it's an experience that maybe a lot of people take for granted.
Dating, hooking up, meeting somebody, it can be tricky for pretty much everyone. But Nava says that's especially true for trans people. Nava draws from her own experiences in the film and says dating was always difficult.
I've dealt with loneliness my whole life. I grew up being very feminine. People just read me as queer. Then when I identified as genderqueer, dating structures just weren't built for me. And frankly, I just really didn't date anybody.
Genderqueer individuals don't express traditional male or female genders. When she was 23, Nava says she realized she was a woman and decided to transition. She was hopeful in a way.
At each stage of my transition, I have kind of wondered if, like, oh, maybe now finally dating will be more accessible to me.
But according to a recent study, as a trans woman, Nava's dating life is even more complicated now. Karen Blair, a researcher at St. Francis Xavier University, looked into trans dating almost by accident.
We were just saying, hypothetically, who of any of these would you consider? Please check all that apply.
She was actually studying how peer and parental approval affect dating. And as a first step, she wanted to know who participants might date. As it turns out, very few check the trans male, trans female boxes.
So I think the actual number was 87.5% of our sample, which was just under 1,000 people, said that they wouldn't date any trans people.
Trans women, in particular, Karen found were the most excluded. In Nava's film, Sophia decides to disclose she's trans on the Uber ride back to Isaac's house.
Well, I'm a trans woman.
There's a long pause. Isaac doesn't look happy.
Yeah, I'm not cool with that.
Sophia gets out of the car.
Bye, I guess.
Nava says the way Sophia discloses while she's still in the car before she gets to Isaac's, it's strategic.
The anxieties around having to disclose that I'm trans are tied to my safety. They're tied to concerns about whether or not I will survive the night.
In the car, Sophia's got the driver right there. She's not alone in the house with Isaac. She doesn't know if he's dangerous.
There's a level of safety planning that we have to practice in our daily lives, and especially in situations like this.
A lot of this, Nava says, she had to basically learn on her own. There's no handbook for dating while trans. In the film, Isaac eventually pulls back around in the car, and the pair continue to his place. But he acts differently. He's not charming or funny anymore. He's a jerk. He's aggressive. Nava has lived this scene in her real-life dating.
I've experienced many times after I disclose that men will see me purely as a sexual object, or reveal that those were his intentions in the first place.
In the end, Sophia decides she's had enough. She gets up and walks out the door.
I'm proud of you.
Nava says it was important to show a trans person doing the decision making.
I think one of the reasons that I've remained single and have not ended up in very many relationships is because I'm choosing to only accept intimate experiences and romantic relationships where I'm respected, where I feel valued, and that feel genuine.
Even if her potential dating pool may be a smaller one, she's not going to compromise.
Otherwise, I say no thank you. And I exit, much like Sophia does in the film.
Karen, the researcher, says, yeah, things can be tough. But her data isn't all doom and gloom. There are very few trans people. Maybe 1 in 200 Americans identify as trans. And Karen says that probably contributes to dating exclusion. Many of those surveyed who excluded trans people may have never met a trans person.
It really just, you know, they don't really understand what it means to be trans.
She says for some people, it may just be a question of exposure or education, and their survey answers would likely flip to include trans people. And Nava says, despite how Sophia's night went, good dates are still very possible for trans folks. Nava's been on a few herself. She tells me about some she had in Oakland, California.
So I was there for this party, this dance party, because I'm there to dance.
But on her way out,
super cute and just very charming. And so we exchanged numbers.
A few dates later, brunch, a baseball game, Nava says a familiar anxiety came back. He wanted to take things to the bedroom. She wanted to disclose she was trans.
And in between kisses, I just blurted it out. And he looked at me and he said, I already know.
She dropped some clues in earlier dates without really thinking about it, saying how she used to look way different, went through some big changes in her life. He just figured it out at some point.
It was such a relief. And then, like, I had the best sex I've ever had in my life.
That story was reported by Jed Slayman. This is The Pulse. We're talking about identity and what happens when our sense of self is challenged. Alan Yu introduces us to somebody who has two distinct identities that seem to complement each other in surprising ways.
Federica Bianco has her long black hair tied back into braids. She's lean and quick on her feet, dodging punches and hitting back at her opponent.
There's something about the competition in the ring and being in the ring that is very sort of meditative. I'm not sure that calm is the right word, but it's a place of very much focus. And it's very liberating because it narrows down the things that you're thinking of. You kind of had to be just thinking about the person that is trying to punch you and how not to get punched and how to punch them inside.
Being a professional boxer takes a lot of training.
Let's keep rope for about 3 rounds just to warm up. And then I will shadow box for maybe 4 rounds. And then I'll hit the bag. Probably I'll do 6 rounds at the regular heavy bags. And then I'll just do some calisthenics like abs or things like that that are very non-exciting, but you kind of just have to do every once in a while.
This hour-long workout is the bare minimum for her daily routine. If she has a fight coming up, she spends even more time training and sparring. She just came back from the TED conference in Vancouver because she has another full-time job. She's an astrophysicist.
Boxers are always surprised, which is intriguing because there are boxers all over the spectrum. Photographers, performance artists, writers, so I'm not sure why astrophysicists would stick out, but it does.
And then other people are surprised she's willing to take a punch.
And a lot of people that generally when I talk to them say, like, aren't you worried that you are gonna hurt your brain boxing, you know? Obviously, I really don't want to downplay the seriousness of brain injuries in impact sports. But also, I don't think that's a problem that only scientists have. If you have a brain injury and you reduce your mental capacity that is a problem that you have as a scientist or as any other person that has any other job, I think.
In fact, she does see some similarities between boxing and astrophysics.
I think there is something to being in a male-dominated sport or in a male-dominated activity that must speak to me because I do both physics and boxing, and they're both obviously very male-dominated fields. I don't like being told that I cannot do things, and I kind of want to react to that by showing that I can. I was told once by a doctor that he had troubles imagining somebody that looked like me doing something as difficult as astrophysics.
He told her this while he was stitching her hand that she had cut while cooking.
On one hand, I didn't really want him to poke my hand through. On the other hand, I thought that was a really enraging comment.
And then there are people in the boxing world who think women shouldn't be boxers. Federica says female boxers are paid nowhere near as well as their male counterparts. There are managers who just don't work with women. Women's boxing didn't become an Olympic sport until 2012. And in an oddly specific way, there are also scientists who think she shouldn't be fighting at all.
Meaning that they, if they think about boxing as a very violent sport, they may not see that as on the same ethical level as something as noble as science.
But most of her colleagues are supportive.
They generally appreciate the breaking the stereotypes type of thing that, you know, to show that scientists are not just lab rats, but also have lives and interests and all possible passions, including combat sports. It's ridiculous to think that they would think about science 100% of the time. Would make for a very bad scientist, I think.
She says boxing actually makes her a better scientist.
They're both problem-solving activities. When you're boxing, you're really faced with a puzzle, and the skill is to not to get overwhelmed and to see what the other person does wrong so that you can take advantage of that. That is a puzzle, and so is science, right? You're faced with a problem, and you have to figure out what is the right strategy to address it. I think that doing multiple things improves your ability to think about a problem from multiple angles. And so improves your creativity, ultimately. One thing that boxing really improved for me is my self-confidence, my ability to withstand stress and to think about problems calmly and lucidly, because that's really all that boxing is about. So as a woman in science, it increased my confidence, it increased my self-esteem, and that is just priceless. You're not allowed to use any of the sounds where I am not.
Alan Yu reported that story. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Andreas Copes is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.